Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Welcome to another exciting episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast. My name is Thomas, your host and a partner at Strategy and. I must admit that I've been eagerly anticipating today's episode ever since we received confirmation from our guest, as it's really truly a special occasion for me as I'm taking a trip down my personal memory lane, because this episode brings me back to the University of Oxford, where I partly studied molecular medicine almost 20 years back. And it's, yeah, you know, one of the most renowned academic centers all over the world, home to the oldest university in the English-speaking world. And this is where my guest for today is researching rare diseases and innovative treatments. So a very warm welcome to Professor Matthew Wood. Matthew is the director and chief scientific officer at the Oxford Harrington Rare Disease Center, which is a transatlantic partnership between the University of Oxford and the Harrington Discovery Institute in the US. Additionally, he is a professor of neuroscience at the University of Oxford and the deputy head at the university's Medical Sciences Division. He's also an adjunct professor of medicine at the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine and a research VP at Muscular Dystrophy UK, which is a charity for people with muscle wasting and weakening conditions. Beyond all his academic roles, Matthew is also a co-founder of several spin-out companies and is on the board of directors of the UK Rare Therapies Launchpad, which is a new initiative that aims to develop a pathway for children with rare conditions to access individualized therapies. He truly is a pioneer in the development of novel drug delivery systems that include peptides and exosome-based technologies for the targeted delivery of macromolecular biologics. He is also an author of an impressive more than 450 scientific papers, and he is an advisor to numerous research funding agencies as well as the pharma industry. So in short, Matthew is truly a trailblazer in neuroscience with a clear vision to improve the lives of people with rare diseases. I'm truly and incredibly honored to have you on the Strategy and Insider podcast today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Matthew, you did graduate medicine from the University of Cape Town back in 1987. After working in clinical neuroscience, you've also then gained a doctorate in physiological sciences at the University of Oxford back in 1993. Can you share with our listeners and myself, obviously, what motivated you to undertake your PhD exactly here at Oxford? And how has that time probably also influenced yourself in any further career decisions since?
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you. In 1987, when I was working in Cape Town and training, it was a difficult time in the country then. It was a very interesting political time. One of the things that we had was incredible clinical training. There was access to learning about an enormous diversity of diseases. The clinical skills we acquired were enormous, but the research training that we had was quite limited. And so for me, wanting to pursue a career in advancing research that could benefit patients, it made sense to think about somewhere in the world that I could go and study to do a PhD. I'd already been doing some research in Cape Town, actually, that had a link with one of the professors here in Oxford. And it was through that link, which was totally unrelated to rare diseases. In fact, it was to do with endocrinology at the time, that I found my way here. I won a fellowship to fund my work and my PhD training in Oxford. And it was through that collaborative link that I ended up coming here for the very first time to do my PhD. Yeah.
Interesting. So a bit of by chance and a bit of by luck, but yeah. Also, I mean, it must have treated you well, otherwise you wouldn't have spent such a long time here, right?
that's very, very true. And I mean, the other part of your question, of course, is how has it influenced me? I think you're right. It has treated me very well. I think it's a theme we may come back to at several points in the discussion, but I think the thing that influenced me most is the people here. Mm-hmm. And some of the people I got to meet during my PhD, the research that I learned about, not my own necessarily, the other work that was going on in Oxford, the people I met, the incredibly exciting environment it was here, I think has really shaped much of my career, my decision making, subsequently for the subsequent 30 years. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And today we're recording in the offices of the Oxford Harrington Rare Disease Center, called OHC, on a dedicated medical campus close to the University of Oxford. And obviously we're surrounded by many new buildings, and buildings kind of still do get built while we speak here. And I vividly remember the awe that I felt when I first arrived myself here as a student back in 26, surrounded by such a history and legacy in one place. What is it that makes Oxford special to you personally? And do you still experience that very special feeling, very special vibe that does exist here in Oxford, aside of the people?
Yeah, I do. I think, it's hard to say that Oxford is unique. I mean, there are certainly some unique things about this place, but I would say probably there are not too many places like it in the world that combine, you know, immense history, immense legacy of the past 800 years with a really exciting modern research environment, intellectual environment that Oxford does. And I think, as I mentioned, the people, but I think that it's not just that there are exceptional colleagues and people who are just a joy to work with. It's the depth of talent across so many disciplines in one place, you know, from classical studies to history to business to economics to, and all the medical disciplines. And this town, which you obviously know, is, you know, about 2 miles by 2 miles. So all of this expertise and this enormous talent is just packed into
very condensed
4 square miles. so the chance interactions with people, new ideas you hear about is truly exciting. And I think that is just the thing that continues from day to day being in this town.
And good ideas is probably a good segue, because I did mention in my introduction that you have also co-founded several companies that focus on genetic diseases. Mm. While this certainly aligns with your scientific expertise, that we'll come to that in a second, founding a company obviously is a whole different endeavor compared to the researching of rare diseases and writing of academic papers, as we know. Can you share with us, in your very personal experiences, what have been the biggest challenges and also learnings that you've made along the way?
Yes, I think, I mean, things have changed here in this town, in Oxford, over the last 10, 15 years in terms of the ease and the enthusiasm for creating new companies. But I think from my perspective, it's now almost an obvious step if you really want your research to have an impact on the real world, and in my case, on patients. Mm-hmm. So it's a fundamental step that's really critical to getting new ideas and technologies that you might develop in the academic lab quickly and tested quickly in the real world and developed so that they can have a benefit. So I think that's the motivation. That's why I'm a real believer that this is something we almost have an obligation to do in order to get our research to benefit humanity. But it does provide challenges, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are challenges. It's, you know, balancing one's academic obligations, responsibilities, day-to-day activities with the priorities of being involved with new companies. That's challenging just in terms of responsibilities and time. Mm-hmm. But actually developing the companies themselves is really challenging. The multiple steps through from all the initial financing, managing all the intellectual property, how this is licensed from the university to the company. There are many of these steps. And then, of course, finding really talented people to work in the company is still a big, big challenge. People who really have the right commercial mindset and can really take forward the early academic ideas and turn them into something that really can work in practice. So, yeah, some real challenges.
And can I just ask, because that's also frequently what you're discovering when talking to a kind of an excellence hub like Oxford, but also if you go to Boston area, if you go to else places, is funding of innovative ideas and private equity or some sort of rich financers. Is that kind of readily available here in Oxford? Has that changed also over the last years?
It has. It has. So this is one of the big changes that's catalyzed fundamental changes within the university in the last 10 years. An Oxford-based venture capital company with a partnership, a clear partnership with the university, was established in 2015, 10 years ago, called Oxford Science Enterprises. Mm-hmm. And I think that the very fact that that private venture company is based here and has a dedicated partnership with the university to work with academics and to look for investment opportunities has really catalyzed a huge change in the way that academics here see the path towards creating new companies. But there are still challenges in the financing. Even if some of the early seed investment is more readily available, ultimately you need larger quantities of capital beyond that. And clearly, we need to look beyond Oxford and beyond the UK to investors globally to support the later development of these companies. But at least the early stages is much more well embedded in Oxford, and it's much more part of the kind of routine thinking that many of the academics here, many of my colleagues will have in their work.
Oh, but that's very encouraging to hear because, I mean, this is obviously one of the parts of the engine that you need to spin off the innovation that's happening in the lab.
Absolutely.
To really make it to patients in the end. That's what counts. So the OHC is a transatlantic partnership between the University of Oxford, as said, and the Harrington Discovery Institute based in Cleveland, Ohio. The latter is actually a family-founded drug discovery institute that was established back in 2012 that does provide support and resources for the early development stages of high-risk therapeutic candidates. Can you explain a little how the OHC came into being and what are its benefits, but also challenges that you are having with this setup, being also a transatlantic partnership?
So the thing in Oxford that became obvious to us about probably 10 years ago, maybe a bit more, was that we had immense research capability in rare diseases. And you obviously knowing Oxford might appreciate that actually we didn't really know this. The expertise was distributed throughout the university, throughout many different departments, you know, from fundamental sciences such as chemistry and computation all the way through to our hospitals. And we didn't know that this huge aggregate of 300 or more people existed. We discovered that we had this immense research, we're probably the biggest research capability in rare diseases if anywhere in Europe in one place. We didn't realize it. So we tried to coordinate this activity better. And through many of our efforts, we became aware of the efforts in Cleveland, the Harrington Discovery Institute, which was not working on rare diseases exclusively at the time. And as you mentioned, a family-founded or family-funded, but embedded within the enormous hospital network in Cleveland, which, you know, as you know, the Cleveland Clinic, the University Hospitals in Cleveland, an enormous clinical center. And the model that they'd established, which was really unique, which was to support early stage drug development by academic teams, but to provide those teams with industrial capabilities. Each drug development project in an academic center was provided with industry expertise to support that project. Whatever the expertise was required, whether it was drug discovery, safety, regulatory expertise, a small team would be built around the academic center and around the project to really allow a biotech-type environment within each academic project to exist and to allow that project to flourish. It's a unique model, and the success to date of that model has been really quite astonishing. They've currently funded close to 200 projects, and they fund throughout, and we'll probably come to this, but they'd initially funded throughout the US. They've been looking for the best academic projects wherever they could find them, support those with financing and with a drug development team. And success in their terms counted as a license to a pharmaceutical company, a new spin out, or a clinical trial. And by chance, it turned out that a very high proportion of projects that they were funding initially were rare disease projects by total chance. Mm-hmm. And so we, through discussion with them, decided that we would put their drug development expertise together with our rare disease research capabilities in Oxford to form this new rare disease center, this collaborative partnership, transatlantic partnership, which is called the Oxford Harrington Rare Disease Center. And we did that about 5 years ago because although we recognized we had immense research capabilities here, it was research. It wasn't really directed towards developing treatments. Uh-huh. And that's what we wanted, was to really shift away from doing a lot of the fundamental research, which Oxford is traditionally very good at, towards turning that into treatments that could benefit patients. And we felt this provided us with the real link to the drug development expertise that we lacked and was a route to really amplifying the impact of our own research.
But that is super impressive, to be honest. And it sounds really like translational science from bench to bedside at its best, right?
Yeah.
So that's the whole intention of it.
Absolutely.
I'm already kind of warning you, if you can, please share a few examples later on,
yeah,
on what those kind of projects are. But before jumping there, because I find this very impressive and want to get your perspective on that, your goal, not your personal goal, but the OHC's goal, is to advance 40 drugs into clinical trials over the next decade that aims to help more than 400 to 500 million people that are affected by rare diseases in the world. So how exactly are you pursuing this, to me at least, very ambitious goal? And how long have you come along the journey? And what are some of the most probably promising therapies that have developed ever since?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, it's a very ambitious goal. But just to put it in context, I mean, we say 400 to 500 million people. I mean, we know these types of rare genetic diseases affect about 1 in 17 people globally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's where you get the number of 500 million.
Yeah.
Globally. And 1 in 17 is also a really interesting number because it means in the UK that's probably getting close to 5 million people. It's a lot of people. It also means just in our personal lives, we probably all know about people with a rare disease. So the way to think about this is they are individually very rare diseases. There may be 7 to 10,000. Collectively, they're actually common.
Massive.
It's, yeah. You can think about this as a global epidemic. I mean, yeah, it's on the scale of 500 million people who are affected in one way or another by a rare disease. So I think that's why we believe the effort towards developing treatments is so important. And that's why we believe that setting an ambitious goal of achieving 40 new medicines from our own efforts would make a difference, but it's in some ways it's a drop in the ocean if you think that there are 10,000 diseases. So I think if we get to 40, that would be fantastic. It's ambitious, but it's not enough. So we're constantly thinking about how we can amplify the work that we're doing so that actually 40 could lead to 50 or 100, or some of those therapies could benefit more than one disease. You know, these are the thinking that we are building into our work so that the amplification effects could be even greater. So the model we have is one that we've built jointly with our colleagues in Cleveland, where we have funding, philanthropic funds that we can use to support early stage drug development of many projects, many programs. And then as those projects progress and some are successful and some fail, we are then in a position to put additional capital and expertise towards the projects as they progress in our efforts to get these into clinical testing. So we've established this pipeline of philanthropic funding, investment funding, all the expertise we need and the scientific teams to support these projects. And just as an indicator of our progress, because we'll probably come back to this, I imagine, we have somewhere now between 15 and 20 programs in progress.
Okay.
Because this is really the second year of our fully fledged operations, mm-hmm, if you like. But we also have some later stage projects which have come in through the investment stage. So for example, a year ago, just over a year, we started to invest, support an effort in an early company called Alveogene, the very first one we supported as the Oxford Harrington Centre, which is a company developing treatments for rare lung diseases. Uh-huh. And they have two or three programs which are getting to the clinical stage for very rare, in some cases very rare, lung diseases. So that's an example of an early stage company. We're looking at three or four more companies that we can bring in at that stage, as well as the very early projects that come into our pipeline. So that's currently where we are, with about 15 projects, early stage projects, and one company, but another three or four that we hope will be within our pipeline by the end of the year.
Probably after talking a little about what the OHC has as a focus and also a vision, probably coming back to your personal research focus, that is a lot around the development of RNA-based medicines for neuromuscular diseases, as said before, especially Duchenne, which is a genetic disorder that causes progressive muscle degeneration and weaknesses through the alteration of a protein called dystrophin that actually helps muscle cells intact. The disease primarily affects boys and begins in the early childhood, as we know. You personally, why have you actually chosen to focus on this disease? And what have been bigger achievements ever since you have been working on it? And you have been referencing that you're doing your research already 30 years. So you must have seen a lot of progress since.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it's I almost got into this particular area of work by chance. I mean, this is often...
To be honest, I was exactly expecting that. Yeah, normally, it happens like this,
it
right?
It happens like this. I mean, I do remember as a clinical student when I was training in medicine, seeing some of these patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy and thinking this is, you know, what a terrible disease. Mm. And we could do absolutely nothing to help the patients at that point in time. But then the chance, the serendipity came through meeting somebody in Oxford who turned out to be a pioneer and one of my colleagues, one of my senior colleagues when I was a PhD student, a woman by the name of Kay Davies, who was one of the people in the 1980s who had discovered the gene that caused this disease. And there were two or three diseases a bit like this that became known about very early on in the genome revolution, where the genes were discovered. This was one, Huntington's disease was another, cystic fibrosis was another, where the genes were characterized. And, you know, strangely enough at the time, you know, people thought, well, these should be easy to solve. We already know what the gene is, and we know what the mutations are, and we know we have some ideas as to how we could correct this. And this was way back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and you would think these would be easy to solve. So we had enough of a head start. We had local expertise in all the genetics, and through that, I got involved in this work, and that began probably 25 years ago. Now, much has changed, and in that time, which I can tell you about very briefly, but what we have realized with most of these diseases is that they are much more complicated than we had originally appreciated. A disease like muscular dystrophy, it has a single gene, should be simple to fix, but it's the largest gene in the genome, which is complicated. It needs to be corrected virtually everywhere in the body, so not just every muscle, because it's a muscle disease and it's a predominantly a muscle gene, but it affects the heart, it affects the brain, it affects many other tissues in the body. So any therapy must correct the abnormalities in all of these tissues of the body. And those are just two of the immense challenges. The size of the gene and the need to actually correct the abnormalities in that gene throughout the body. And muscle tissue is the largest tissue in the body in terms of body weight. So the RNA therapy is a therapy that we began working on 23 years ago with a number of groups in the world. It's been an enormous collaborative effort. The treatment, actually, to correct mutations in the gene is a treatment called exon skipping. It uses an RNA approach. It really works. It's amazing. In a cell, in a dish, or even in an animal, you can get this to work perfectly. The challenge has really been, how do you get this to work in every muscle and in the heart and in the brains of these patients? And that is ongoing. So we played a role in the first drug that was approved by the FDA in 2016. That was after 14 years of work. There have now been four or five medicines approved by the FDA, but they don't work very well, and they're only applicable to small numbers of, well, to subgroups of patients, not not to all patients. So there's still a lot of work ongoing, and most of our personal work, my personal work that's currently ongoing, is about how we can deliver these drugs more effectively around the body and into the affected tissues like the muscles and the heart, so that we can get drugs which we know do work actually into the right cells so that they can effectively work in patients. And that's still the barrier. So we have new treatments which are now in clinical trials, which have come out of our labs, working with a range of companies around the world. And it looks very exciting, it looks promising, but it's an immensely challenging disease to work on.
If you could make a kind of an indication on a scale from 0 to 100, 0 being kind of in the infant stage of research and nothing at hand and you can't really help the patient, versus 100% is a cure. Yeah? Yep. No one needs to worry about. What do you see Duchenne currently on that scale?
Yeah, I'll answer the question in a minute. while I think about it, but I think what you have to remember as well is that the first therapy was approved in 2016. Mm-hmm. Okay, so for the whole of human history prior to that, there was nothing, absolutely nothing, and that treatment that was first approved in 2016 doesn't work very well, as I've said. But what that did was to raise immense hope amongst the scientific community, but particularly patients, that a treatment, an effective treatment, could be developed. So that was a huge step change. But that also catalyzed huge research activity in many companies, huge investment that came into the whole field to work on new therapeutic approaches once the first one was approved. So I think that first step was a very, very important first step. So it's almost why I would say on your scale of 0 to 100, that we're probably somewhere near 60 or 70, because everyone knows this is now possible. We really have seen examples of the first treatments emerging, and we know what problems need to be solved to really make those treatments even better. So although there's a long way to go, I would say we are way past halfway, because I think there's enormous optimism, but there's real belief. I mean, I believe before I stop working, in 10 years' time, we will definitely have solved this problem.
That is really promising.
And that's really what's changed since 2016. I think we all now believe this is possible. And it's true for all the rare diseases, actually, that we'll come on to. I think the technology to solve these problems exists. And we just have to understand how to apply it, how to optimize it, how to do it safely, you know, how to make the treatments cost-effective, and the patients will benefit.
And rare diseases, by the nature of its name, are rare. Yeah? So depending on where in the world you are looking, sometimes it's one in 1,500, one in 2,000, sometimes it's five in 10,000. There is a lot of different kind of numbers out there. Bottom line, this makes obviously researching of those illnesses and also developing some of the potential treatments that you've just mentioned also very expensive if you look at and watch it from a per person perspective, right? And hence there might be also less attractiveness to some of the pharma industry players, as there might be somewhat of a limited commercial potential. Not everywhere, but surely the ultra-rare diseases, there is only few patients. From your perspective, as you are an expert since so many years, what are necessary kind of changes to the framework in the development of so-called orphan drugs? And what is actually needed from a regulatory perspective, but also those companies, pharma companies that are actually investing into it to make it really kind of value at big scale to a lot of the patients?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting, because I think if you look around at lots of the companies working this, they all tend to focus on working on the same diseases. Uh-huh. So although there are 7 or 10,000 rare diseases, actually the focus for most of the companies is on a small group of probably fewer than 20, often 10, because those are thought to be the most commercially attractive opportunities to work on. And, you know, they have been de-risked by early treatments which aren't particularly effective, and the pathway through a regulatory agency is already well understood, and everyone therefore converges on a very small number. So, I mean, your question's a really, really important one. I think there are things which are important. The first is, one of the big changes is genetics, and our ability through modern genome technology, the costs of which are coming down enormously to rapidly sequence genomes, make diagnoses, and make this information available. So, for example, this can be done almost overnight now. The costs are very low. So one of the things about that is we can find patients for clinical trials much mm-hmm. more readily. That's more commercially attractive. But also, we can actually more accurately estimate the numbers of patients who would benefit from certain treatments. And actually, many of our estimates in the past have been underestimates. So that would also make it more commercially mm-hmm. attractive to be able to access patients quickly, the right types of patients, and know how many patients that are out there in terms of a market. So that is all going to make a very big difference. But I think the most fundamental change we probably need is a regulatory one. Mm-hmm. You know, our regulatory systems, you know, particularly in the US, which is probably the most important one we always have to think about, but even in the UK and Europe, were designed for an era of 50 years ago where the drugs were small molecule drugs, and they were designed to treat hundreds of thousands of patients for the big diseases.
Agreed.
And now we're looking at an era of genetic drugs or advanced biologics that are often designed to treat very small numbers of patients. And we really need to think about how we can change the regulatory pathways that are not just better suited for rare diseases, but that are better suited for these types of genetic drugs and the small patient groups that are likely to benefit from them. And I think two of the biggest changes that I think are necessary, you know, we're in very close collaborative discussions, particularly with our regulatory agency in the UK, the MHRA, who have demonstrated a real willingness to be innovative and open to changes, are around safety, which is always crucial, but not necessarily having to go through all the steps of safety that would historically have been the case, particularly all the animal safety testing. Ultimately, we want to do safety on patients. All the safety testing should be done with direct relevance to the patients. And so we're working now on ways that we could, for example, do safety in human cell models, you know, all of these advanced stem cell models, or cells that we can take from patients, or sophisticated organ models from patients. That is probably a better type of safety assay than doing studies in rodents or other animals. So can we modify the safety pathway to do this much, much more quickly in human models, for example? And then can we be better at gathering safety data from the patients themselves once we've started to treat them and sharing that data in real time with regulators so that we can monitor much more carefully the safety of early treatments in patients and substitute that for expensive, very long, time-consuming studies in animals, as just one example.
And listening to that, obviously technology must play a very vital role in this, right? So if we think of predictive analytics in silico trial arms, in silico organ models, you can simulate a lot, and you can learn a lot, especially if you have a rare number of patients.
Exactly. And so I think building in that kind of computational predictive models is crucial. And we're in the early stages, but that should allow us to move much, much more rapidly through the early stages and allow us to circumvent some of the regulatory steps which have been in place for many years. But the other thing about many of these types of genetic treatments is that you typically have a genetic platform. And what you would do from patient to patient or disease to disease is to change one small component of that platform. Mm-hmm. That would be specific for one patient, and you would change it for another or for another group of patients. So why, therefore, do we have to prove the safety of the whole platform repeatedly every time we change a small component of that? And this is an ongoing dialogue with the regulators, but I think they really understand that if they have a huge amount of safety data on the platform, it may not be necessary to repeat that at enormous cost and enormous time, consuming time, just to change the small component that is going to differ from patient to patient or disease to disease. So it's really very exciting, and I think regulators appreciate the need for change, and this will catalyze ultimately the ability to do this much, much more rapidly and effectively for patients.
So from a medical perspective, diagnosing a rare disease must be also quite complex for physicians, as the symptoms do vary not only from a disease to a disease, but also from a patient to patient, even with the same disease. Initiatives like Rare Disease Day, that is annually celebrated in February, obviously does help raise awareness of rare diseases. However, a lack of specific knowledge about the very particular rare disease often leads to also misdiagnosis and delayed treatment. Given your background in this field, which advancements do you think could play a pivotal role in improving the diagnosis and also the understanding of rare diseases in the field?
Mm. Yeah. So I think this is one of the things that is really changing rapidly. I think for many patients that you would talk to, they would tell you about this immense odyssey journey they went on to get a diagnosis mm-hmm. that may have taken 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years or more to ultimately get a diagnosis. And so this has been a real barrier for a long time. So the big change really, as we've mentioned, is genome technologies, mm-hmm. the ability to look at the whole genome in a single patient, because often finding the genetic causes of these diseases is not easy, as easy as we thought it was. And often the mutations are buried away in some obscure part of the genome, not exactly where you think it is. And having access to the whole genome with a really high fidelity genome sequencing is the first step to doing that. And this is now possible. But building on that, the next step, which has been happening in the UK and only one or two other places really, is beginning to do this on large numbers of people routinely. So through Genomics England, which is our major sort of genome center in the UK, they have been doing genome sequencing on hundreds of thousands, probably close to 1 million people. And it's only when you start to do this at population levels that you can really begin to see what is normal, what is abnormal, but also to begin to search for the errors that cause diseases, and then common ways in which it may be possible to treat or correct these. So all of this comes out from not just having one genome, but having multiple genomes and hundreds of thousands, which is what we do have now. So that's the next step, which is now in progress. And I think the third step, which again is only just beginning to be done at a population level, is to sequence the genomes of newborn babies. So newborn screening. Mm-hmm. So this has happened sporadically in a few places, but doing this systematically in a population is being contemplated. Now, Genomics England here in the UK has started this with a pilot study beginning actually this year, uh-huh. where I forget the actual numbers of newborn babies that they will screen, but it's thousands, gathering that information. And this will be the start of the revolution, where you could actually diagnose these diseases at birth for the first time. Now, it's challenging. There are many ethical questions around this. What do you do with the information? Because there will be a huge amount of information, genetic information, that will
Absolutely.
Be acquired.
Yeah.
But even if you just limit your analysis of that to, for example, 100 or 200 rare diseases that we know already, and that maybe we could do something about therapeutically, that would be an immense step forward. So this is now happening, because I think the real importance of this is that for most of these diseases, the patients, at least at birth, are not yet severely affected. So you're getting the diagnosis before the symptoms develop, whereas historically, patients develop diseases, come to their doctors, it takes 5 years, and at that point, they are well down the road of having the disease progressed. And in almost every single case, we now believe the treatments would be more effective if you treat before the disease develops rather than afterwards.
And as part of the OHC, you also have a Rare Disease Scholar Award to honor promising discoveries that are coming from academic labs, obviously helping them to transition into clinical practice. Since in 2024, you had the first laureates out of that. Can you share a few highlights that you found amongst those year's prize winners? What stands out with them, and why did they actually get such an award?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is one of our major mechanisms for launching new drug development programs, is this Scholar Award. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was extremely exciting. We had over 100 applications from Canada, the US, and the UK. And I mean, a very high proportion of them were exceptionally good. So I think we probably got down to about 60, but those 60 were all exceptionally good. In the end, we funded 10. And so I think that was the first thing I was immensely pleased with, was just to see such high quality rare disease proposals and early stage drug discovery programs that applied for these awards. The second thing was a really nice geographic balance. So out of the 10, 6 were in the US, 3 in the UK, 1 in Canada, which is great. A really nice balance across different disease areas, from rare cancers to rare brain diseases to rare metabolic diseases. So that was, again, fantastic. So just to pick out one or two of those, one of those is a project from a really fantastic team in Boston, led by an investigator called Tim Yu. He's really pioneered approaches for developing individualized treatments for small numbers of patients mm-hmm. for these very rare brain diseases. He's really, over the last five years, been one of the world leaders in developing that. And so he's proposed a new program for a very rare brain disease to develop an individualized genetic treatment for that. So we're really excited to support that one. And then an example from the UK is some new technology for rare cancers, rare childhood cancers, which are actually surprisingly common. Mm. And so this is some of the new CAR T-cell technology, but particularly evolved towards certain childhood cancers that has come out of a team in London. Uh-huh. And we're supporting a program from them. So I think really contrasting types of programs from the three countries, but highlighting different diseases, different therapeutic approaches, and all of these, we believe as well, could be potential platforms. So as these progress, they will hopefully qualify for further investment and could develop into therapeutic platforms and new companies that could benefit more than just one disease eventually. But the initial focus is really quite sharp on a single problem to prove that the approach and the platform could work.
Matthew, I really want to say thank you. Thank you for that very vivid conversation that we had, the open sharing of thoughts and experiences that you gave us, and also for giving really some hope, some big hope around regulation is catching up, a lot of innovation happening, funding being there, and there is a lot of hope, I think, at least in me and sure also with the listeners, that there is improvement coming for the lives of rare disease patients. And I want to thank you also for all your work that you're putting in there. Really incredible. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
No, thank you. It's a pleasure. And imagine a world where a patient can walk into their physician, receive a diagnosis, and a few weeks later receive a treatment for a rare disease. That could happen in 10 years' time. And we hope to be part of making that possible. So thanks for the opportunity to tell you about it.
So thank you very much, everybody, for joining today's Strategy and Insider podcast. Please do not forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform, as we really appreciate your support and look forward to bringing you more thought-provoking episodes in the future. Until then, stay safe.
Strategy and Strategy made real.